at str.org. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, Christianity Worth Thinking About, ladies and gentlemen. It's usually a tournament of thought in every show. This particular hour is just a little different, not in that it's not about thinking carefully about things that matter, because that's part of what we're doing right now, but it is about another part of the equation. My guest, Dr. J.P. Moreland, and a friend and mentor of mine personally, that has been a tremendous help in my own life, As a mentor in my thinking life. He's, of course, founder of the Influential Master's Program in Philosophy, Religion, and Ethics at Talbot School of Theology, and he's got four earned degrees, PhD from USC in philosophy, and just, I can't keep track of the books, JP, but we've had you on the air probably for every one of them over the last 10 or 12 years, but arguably this one is going to hit people in a way that none of the others do because the target's different. The title is The Lost Virtue of Happiness, Discovering the Disciplines of the Good Life. J.P. Moreland and Klaus Isler co-authored. Nav Press is the publisher. Jay, on page 39, you really turn a corner here after the introduction in the book that really follows what we've been talking about up till now, that happiness is greatly misconstrued in modern life. Here's what you say. Let me make what may seem to be an unusual statement. Christianity is an aesthetic religion that is a faithful pursuit of the glory of God, whose transforming power is tapped by regular and rigorous discipline and self-denial done in constant dependence on the filling power of the Holy Spirit. Regular, rigorous discipline and self-denial. These are not things that you hear frequently in evangelical Christianity, Jay.
Well, and that's because we don't hear it in the culture. I mean, think with me about this, Greg. Suppose that we define happiness the way it is today, as to whether I'm feeling really pumped up about something and just, man, I'm really
jazzed,
excited. What the focus of my life will be is on me.
Uh-huh.
And Jesus was not kidding when he said the way you gain your life is you lose it. And the way to become a happy person in the deeper sense of a person who knows how to live life well is to learn the art of giving yourself away to others. And so C.S. Lewis has this very interesting little story where he says that if you want friends, you don't want to go into a room of people and do all the talking and try to make people impressed with what a great person you are and how much they're missing out by not knowing
mm-hmm.
you. What you want to do is learn to be a friend, and that means learn to listen, learn to be able to deflect attention to other people, and that sort of thing. And mm-hmm. so there are ways to train and discipline yourself, and by discipline I don't mean, you know, self-flagellation and
or asceticism or something like that.
Yeah, think of a person. Let's think of two definitions of freedom. The contemporary definition of freedom is the right to do what you want.
Mm-hmm.
The classic definition is the power to do what I ought. And so I have a friend who can sit down at a piano, and he can play that thing like you can't believe, and he's got freedom with respect to that piano I don't have.
Mm-hmm.
But that freedom was purchased at the price of hours upon hours of habit formation and training and discipline. While I was watching TV, he was learning to play the piano. Now, you apply that to life. Suppose that I want to get to the point where I am not a worrywart anymore. You can actually make progress in learning to lay down constant worry, but it will take exercise and training and
mm-hmm.
focus. And there are certain activities that you can do to engage in that. You can pause at different times during the day and try to feel in your heart the things you're carrying.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually go through the act of releasing these. You can open your hands as a symbol of releasing these to God and lay them at his feet. And then you can begin to train your mind to think about a positive, in the Philippians 4 sense, whatever is true, whatever is
right,
good, whatever is pleasurable. And you can begin to form the habit of thinking about those things. But you have to do it by yielding your heart day by day to God's filling. You don't want to try it on your own. But that doesn't mean you don't do something. But I like the attitude of approaching this entire area of discipline with a fundamental spirit of dependency. Now, that's crucial, because then you don't feel alone in it. There is a, Lord, I am dependent on you, and I readily acknowledge my dependence right now.
You know, JP, I think that I might be wrong on this, but I think that most Christians in difficult straits are aware of their of the need to be dependent on God, but they don't know how to express the dependency or to exercise dependency in a fruitful fashion.
Right.
One thing I really liked about your illustration about Lewis there and making friends, and if I got your point right, JP wasn't saying, okay, go out and make more friends. He's saying that if you want to be a friendly person, there is a way to do this.
Absolutely.
There is a practice, and the practice is to do one thing and not the other. And by the same token, in learning how to develop spirituality, there are steps to developing the skills. And one of the things that I appreciate about this book is you go through steps of particular things to learn how to apply yourself. I actually like your learning to play golf illustration as a profound way of helping me get an understanding about what you're getting at when you're talking about this. Why don't you offer that?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you Paul says to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, and he does, and just think about golf. There is such a thing as golf flesh. Now, that may sound funny, but flesh, really in the New Testament, is not the same thing as the body. The body is good. It's this object I'm looking at right now. But the flesh is evil. And the flesh are sinful habits that reside in the body. So, for example, in golf, a person will have golf flesh, and these will be habits in his hips and legs and shoulders and wrists that are not conducive to being good at golf. And so if you want to change, what you have to do is to present your body as a golf to a golf instructor as an instrument of golf righteousness. That just means.
Well, a lot of people are really perking up their ears here, especially the old guys. You know, people ask me if I play golf, and I said I'm not old enough yet for that.
Well, that's right. What that means is that you read up and learn about the proper way to do
it. Absolutely.
Go to an instructor, and you say, here I am. Give me things to train in. And he looks at you and says, your golf flesh resides in your shoulders and your wrists, not your hips and legs. You're fine there. But you've got bad habits in your shoulders. So he gives you an exercise to repeat over and over again. And so by presenting my wrists and my shoulders to the golf instructor as an instrument of golf righteousness, all that means is I yield to his direction. He gives me repetitive habits to do over and over again. I depend upon him because I look to him for guidance and correction. And over time, I form golf character, which replaces the golf flesh. That is, I get new habits, develop old habits. And I'll give you a classic example of this that I mentioned in the book. Years ago, I led a young man to Christ, and I noticed half of his face was deformed. He was a very unattractive person. And he came to a meeting where I shared the gospel, and he sat in the back, and he would not integrate with other people. In fact, he tried to get up and leave as soon as the meeting was over with. And I saw him leaving. He was not very well-dressed, and his hair was very oily. And I noticed why he wanted to leave, because his face was not attractive to look at. And you know that he'd received rejection over and over again. Well, I led this young man to Christ, and instead of exhorting him to be bold in his witness, I began to give him specific things to do that were simple, that like he could go to a street corner and hand out Jesus Underground newspapers. Now, we went from that to a little bit more. When it came to his dating life, I said, Lee, you need to start going out with young ladies in the body here and getting to know some girls, because you just have no relationship with women at all. So we repeated a phone conversation. that he could call a girl and ask her out. And we practiced that. And when I practiced, I gave him things to do in our weekly fellowship meetings where he could at least go up to girls, you know, after the prayer time and just ask them, how's your week been? And I gave him some questions.
So these are baby steps, but they are steps.
Oh,
they are particular things that you engage your body in doing to become more skilled at the virtue you want to develop.
Exactly. And we didn't do it all at once. He practiced that. Well, guess what? Eventually he got to the point to where he asked a girl out on a date, and now he is married. He is a school teacher, which means he stands in front of a class and has people looking at him all day long. Mm-hmm. But now you can imagine, Greg, in the early stages of this, how painful it was to him. And learning to play golf is painful in the early stages.
Mm-hmm.
Learning to disengage from having to have approval from people by learning to be alone and being quiet in solitude is very anxiety producing early on.
Mm-hmm.
You fidget. You don't want to stay. You want to hurry up and get to start doing something because you get antsy.
And solitude is one of the things that you talk about in detail that one can begin practicing that will help them develop the virtues of a happy person.
Oh, it's absolutely critical.
Right. A lot of your book is given to this, and in our last segment coming up in a few minutes, I want to talk almost entirely about your own experiences with depression, because I think this will resonate a lot with parts of our audience, and it's almost never talked about. But I don't want to give the short shrift to this massive section where you actually go through particulars about how to pray simple prayers, the Jesus prayer, for example, just a short one sentence that you can repeat many times during the day, Lord Jesus, have mercy on me.
It has been so meaningful to me to learn to form that spirit prayer all day long.
Yeah, I was a little suspicious. I don't know if that's the right word, but when you first talked about this, and I heard you talk about it at least 10 years ago first, but I found that praying it, not repetitively, but regularly, that the times when I'm just at a loss, or when my heart's just hurting, or when I'm just depressed, and you don't know what to say, and you know I'm supposed to be praying right now, but I don't know what to, just to be able to say, Lord Jesus, have mercy on me.
Have mercy on me.
And the comfort that brings to my heart. And you say you pray it 300 times a day.
Yeah, I used to. I don't need to now. And that's like playing scales. You play the scales not to get good at scales, but so you don't need to play scales.
And like in a piano.
You do a repetitive prayer so that you get to the point where you can enter in more quickly to a deeper focused prayer for your family and your loved ones without your attention span being just 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah, I like what you also said, that you should have 5 or 6 times a day where you get to your knees and pray for 2 or 3 minutes about something.
Very briefly, that's
but
all.
You know why I like that is because that's me. I mean, when I think about, I'm not the kind of guy who's going to fall out of bed and pray for 3 hours. You know, it's just like,
right.
But I can focus in on this thing for 3 minutes, and getting on my knees helps me to focus, and boom. And so it made me feel like this is within my reach to help on a daily basis get me more engaged in the things you're talking about.
I'll tell you, it'll change your life. And this is not a legalistic rule. That has nothing to do with it. If you will form the habit of throughout your day from time to time just getting down briefly and praying out loud on your knees for a very short period of time, I tell you it will start becoming longer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very practical.
It kind of gets things going, and if your expectation is just for those couple minutes, it allows you to focus for those couple minutes, in a sense, gives you the freedom to just do a couple minutes,
Absolutely.
Focus and get the job done and move forward. But if your day is punctuated with that, that has a way of bringing God more to your mind on a regular basis.
Well, and you don't start by playing the Beethoven on the piano. I mean, you start with smaller steps.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't sit down and get on your knees for a half hour. You'll feel guilty. You'll quit. You have to form the habit and get into that. And this is just some simple steps.
Let me talk very quickly here. We got about 3 minutes before the break. About the role of beliefs in influencing behavior. And I was actually in a conversation with some friends, and one person who's a leader in the emerging church movement, I don't want to mention his name, because I'm going to read something he wrote, and I want you to respond to it in light of this whole idea of beliefs driving behavior. He disagrees. He says, writing to a friend of mine, he said, I think your thesis that behavioral change, because my friend is talking about renewing the mind first, and then behavior follows. He says, I think your thesis behavioral change begins with the mind is virtually indefensible by either psychological or biblical standards, he says. While psychologists surely agree that beliefs affect behavior, so do a whole complex matrix of influences, and then he lists them, family upbringing, social mores, gender differences, etc. In fact, I'd argue that most of our behaviors are determined by influences that take place at a pre-reflective or subconscious level. Now, of course, this implies that upbringing and mores don't instill beliefs,
right,
or that beliefs, you can't have beliefs unless you're thinking about them. Both, I know, are foolish contentions,
well,
but this is a postmodern approach.
This is not a cheap trick here, but if he doesn't believe that beliefs change behavior, why would he take the time to say those things? Because what he's trying to do is to change your behavior.
Right, right.
And he's doing it by trying to change your beliefs.
Absolutely.
The truth is that the factors that he mentions do form beliefs.
Yes.
And people hardly ever act contrary to their beliefs. Now, I am not suggesting that we don't also work on your emotions and your habits. Of course, it's a holistic thing, but we really do start with asking ourselves. See, what we haven't done, Greg, is we haven't distinguished between what we believe and what we say we believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what a person actually believes, which is the result of many factors in his life, I'm not denying that, nevertheless shapes what a person is about.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be fair to say, and those, this is not always true because you don't always have the opportunity to act, but the beliefs at least entail a propensity to act as if the thing were so?
Absolutely. And quite frankly, a lot of times people are not in touch with what their real beliefs are.
I mean, this is kind of what James is getting at in James 2. Say you believe, but let's see, you know, show me kind of thing.
Absolutely right. And Paul's statement about being transformed by the renewing of your mind, he's not just talking about being a head tripper there,
mm-hmm.
but he's saying that when you come to think differently about the way the world is or about your wife or your job, if you change your beliefs about your job, it will affect your behavior at work.
Sure, sure. That verse that you just quoted, Romans 12:2, Romans 12:1 is the exhortation, which is also central to your book, is to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. And this is a lot of, you know, getting your bodies involved in things as you talk about there. But it comes at Romans 12:1, starting with the word therefore. In other words, there are 11 chapters of teaching and training to alter beliefs before Paul expects us to surrender our bodies as a sacrifice.
Absolutely right.
Jay, we're at a break right now. I want to come back, and I want to talk about what really is the most intimate part of this book for the reader of you, because everything else you're speaking intimately from your own heart, clearly, and mine. But this talks about you autobiographically and a very dark period that you just recently went through, 7 months of deep depression, and the counsel that you have for Christians with regards to the issue of happiness.
Yes.
When we come back, we'll talk about that. Is that all right?
You bet.
J.P. Moreland, my guest. The book is The Lost Virtues of Happiness, Discovering the Disciplines of the Good Life, published by NAV Press, also co-authored with Klaus Isler. We'll talk with J.P. Moore about one of the most riveting portions of his book, Depression. Greg Kokel, let's stand to reason. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting SCR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Stand to Reason has an absolutely unique cruise conference experience for you this fall. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel, and on September 16th, we'll set sail from Boston with Holland American Cruise Line. We'll enjoy the scenery of the New England coastline, the Canadian Maritimes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, Quebec, and Montreal. In addition to the scenery, you'll enjoy the fellowship of other like-minded Christians and a conference program designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. And I'll be joined by some very distinguished guest speakers. Dr. J. Wesley Richards from the Acton Institute, national radio talk show host Kirby Anderson from Probe Ministries, and Kurt Swindoll of Cool Strategies, who will MC all of our events. Our plan is to stimulate you with challenging presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship, all against the backdrop of New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall. Come join Stand to Reason and our all-star lineup for a memorable spiritual adventure. Space on board is limited, so get the details from 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org. I look forward to seeing you on board.
Bows and flows of angel hair.
Greg Kokel with you here on Stand to Reason. And, of course, this is your place for straightforward, no frills, nothing buttery, real, believable Christianity. That's what we always try to present here for you. My guest, kind of in that spirit, is J.P. Moreland, a tremendous mentor to me in my intellectual development for, gosh, you know, I'm finally graduating, J.P., this spring.
That's kind of the last day right now.
13 years in this program, and I actually met you before that.
Yeah.
So, I understand Tom Crisp is now teaching at Biola, having been a professor in Florida, having gotten his Ph.D. before that at Notre Dame, and Tom and I were in your metaphysics class together.
This is unbelievable.
So I've been around for a long time, and you've been around for a long time in my life. And
I have to say a word about this cruise that was just advertised. I was privileged to go on a cruise with you last summer.
Yes,
it was
great.
It was unbelievable. Yeah. I will say to anybody listening, if you can get away and do this, you will never, I mean never, forget it.
Mm.
It is something that is not to be missed. And that's not, I'm telling you that because that's the gospel.
The check's in the mail, JP.
You know? Yeah, there you go. I'll know that.
Thank you so much, and it was really fine having you with us.
What a time that was.
It was super. Our second cruise, September 16th through 23rd, we're going to the East Coast instead of the West Coast now. We're going to the Canadian Maritimes in New England during the fall.
Oh.
And, of course, J. Wesley Richards, who you know well, will be on that crew.
Kirby,
do you know Kirby Anderson?
I sure do.
Yeah, with Probe, and Kirby's going to be with us then. So we're looking forward to that, and thanks so much for that good word.
Oh, you're welcome.
Chapter 7, Defeating Two Hardships of Life, Anxiety, and Depression, the book Lost Happiness, or rather the Lost Virtues of Happiness. I guess you could say the Lost Happiness.
Well, there you go.
And this is the subject of this chapter. I'm just going to read the first paragraph, which starts quite dramatically, and this is one that you wrote, and so this is about you.
Yes.
While I have always lived with a certain amount of anxiety, I've spent most of my life without the more severe type of anxiety attack or serious depression. A year ago, however, all that changed. I found myself overwhelmed by a set of major stressors that sent me spiraling into an emotional tailspin. Now, it would be sad to know how many people listening to us right now who love the Lord and are serving the Lord can say, that is my life right now. Jay, what happened?
Yeah, Greg, boy, I had a year that was just from hell, 2002, 2003, and at the end of May, I just fell apart. I began to wake up in the middle of the night with panic attacks. I was having irrational fears like I was going to be homeless, that my work had never amounted to anything, and this fear and the stress that had been on me drove me into a 7-month period of depression that was so deep that while I was afraid to commit suicide and never thought about that, I would have been fine if died. I didn't really want to live.
Lord, take me home.
Very dark time.
Mm-hmm. It says here, I got to the point where it took great effort for me to do simple things like answer the phone or pay the bills.
I was actually scared when the phone rang. I didn't want the phone to ring.
Mm.
I was not functional.
You know, I would imagine that would be exceptionally terrifying, or especially terrifying for a guy like you who has really so many responsibilities. You really, in one sense, it doesn't seem like you can check out. You've got a family, you've got a university, that you've got writing, you've speaking. I mean, and that must have just added to the burden.
It was the abyss, let me tell you. And I basically had no alternative but to check out. I was filled with anxiety and depression, and it was a rough time.
Now, what did you learn in the process, Jay?
Well, I learned a ton.
This is the longest chapter in the book, I think, as I'm looking at it.
There's so much that I can't share in the air, but a handful of things. Number one, I came to appreciate the importance of antidepressant medication. We have a stigma in the Christian community about taking antidepressant medication. I think that we've got to get rid of that. There's a passage in Proverbs 31 in the Old Testament that recommends in those days the use of certain kinds of drugs in the form of alcohol to help deal with depression and deep mood.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an indication that medication can be useful.
I mean, isn't it the case that it, when you're depressed for a long time, that the, your body chemistry actually changes?
Oh, tremendously.
And
your serotonin levels and other chemicals in your brain. So it's no longer then just a spiritual problem.
Mm-hmm.
And what you need is to try to get food for your brain, because you can exhort yourself all you want, but if your brain chemistry is blown out...
You mean literally food for your brain, not food for your mind here, food for your brain.
Yeah. I think the second thing I learned is that I found a good Christian therapist, and I began to explore some issues that had come to me that I just hadn't faced from my early life, tell mm-hmm. the truth, and my father's passing away as a boy. And I began to experience in that process of going to counseling some very helpful insights, some ways to talk to myself differently. And in addition to the medication and counseling, those were two crucial factors.
Well, you mentioned here on the physical aspects, I mean, diet and exercise, you know. I mean, that seems so mundane in a certain sense, but this is part of the physical things that contribute, I guess, to...
Yeah. The problem is that when people start getting depressed, they start shutting down on some of the things they need to sustain to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And exercise, at whatever level a person can accomplish, is absolutely critical, because it really does release mood elevators in the brain that are positive. And even... if a person can do some kind of hard labor, weight training, or work hard with their muscles, that their studies have indicated that that actually helps to get rid of depression.
Actually, the problem, of course, is when you're depressed, you don't want to do the things you know you ought to do.
There's truth, and a person has got to be kind to himself. You have to surround yourself with people, if you can, that will understand and give you space to be where you need to be. I think that's very important. And I also learned a principle of meditating on things that God had done for me that it would be hard for me to describe. It's in the book,
mm-hmm.
but it is a form of meditation that involves meditating not in the mind as much as in your heart area, and meditating on things that bring warm emotion to you, like feelings of compassion or forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Feelings of great appreciation for the things that have happened in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can begin to meditate, you know, Philippians 4 talks about whatever is true, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely. If you look at a good commentary on that, Paul is not talking about meditating on Scripture, interestingly enough. This is a list of meditative practices that even pagan writers would mention.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically talking about meditating on good things in your life that bring joy to your heart. It can be something as simple as a nice car, and it's not because it makes you happy. This can be as a sign of God's mercy and kindness to you. And if you can begin to feel those things in your heart, it can begin to take away some of the depressive feelings. So I would begin to meditate, and I still do this all throughout the day, on things that bring a sense of compassion and appreciation and feeling a great sense of forgiveness and mercy. And I'll give you an illustration. Gary DeWeese, who teaches with me at Talbot, one mm-hmm. day when I was in the middle of this depression, I was walking down the hall, and he walks up to me, and he looks me in the eye and says, "Hey, I want you to know I really love you." And he gave me this big, warm hug and said, "You don't know how much I appreciate you." Let me tell you, Greg, I have gone to that moment many, many times mm-hmm. in my heart, to feel the warmth and the love that he gave me, and just meditating in my heart about that act has had a tremendous healing result in my life.
I can just picture that teddy bear of a guy doing that to you, too.
Yeah, he almost broke my backbone.
Yeah, he's such a sweet guy, though, and you know it's utterly genuine when he says something like that. So there's a sense in which recalling these things. You mentioned in the book that there's actually a neurological element that has to do with the patterns that we think about things.
Well, they've discovered that there are more neurons in the heart than in any of the subregions of the brain. And so there is of course, I think that the soul is what thinks and so on.
Right.
Uses the body. And the heart muscle is an area of what I would simply call intuitive or affective awareness. And sometimes a person gets depressed and they try to obsess on it in their mind,
mm-hmm.
and it literally creates ruts in the brain that keep you from being able to get off these fearful thoughts.
Like physical patterns of thinking that it's hard. There are physical reasons why it's hard to get out of the cycle,
absolutely,
is what you're saying.
It becomes not just a thought thing anymore, but it actually can become a biological thing.
Yeah.
And at that point, you need to try to meditate in your heart area, where you're feeling in your chest.
Now, this was odd to me when I read this, because you said take your mind off your mind, or take your mind off your brain,
right,
and focus on the thoracic region of your body is what we mean here.
That's right. And try
explain that.
To feel what you're feeling there, and put in place of a fearful feeling a great feeling of warmth or affection or kindness that you've received. It can also be something you've given if you gave love to someone that was meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And to try to let that warm emotion set up in your heart area. And then there are ways to return to the fearful thought while you're having that warm feeling that takes the power out of the thought.
So it's not denial of the thought. It's kind of coming at it from another direction where you have more strength to deal with it.
That couldn't have said it better. Absolutely. It's not denial, but it's setting aside for a while so you can come at it from a different point of view so it's not so overwhelming.
Jay, what is the role of friends, spouses, in these kinds of situations? And I say that because for every depressed person there is out there,
yes,
there's a half a dozen people in their immediate circle that are either deeply influenced by the depression and or maybe wants to help and do what they can but are a little lost. Now, you mentioned already giving space and understanding. Is there a role of kind of helping people to function, being a cheerleader? I mean,
we have a chapter on that, and yes, Greg, it's so important that we find fellow sojourners, and by that I mean people that share our overall worldview and values,
mm-hmm,
and who are willing to be sojourners in the valleys and the peaks, mm-hmm, and so that you don't feel like you're sojourning in life alone, but there are others that you have permission to be needy and fearful, and they will come alongside. And of course, when they're going through a valley, you return the favor.
Mm-hmm.
And so you feel like you're a part of this pilgrimage. It's called life. It's a pilgrimage to become more like the Lord Jesus as time goes on. But we all know that there are dark times and positive times in that journey, and you want to feel like you're on pilgrimage with others that,
mm-hmm,
are standing beside you.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there are a lot of people out there that don't realize they're depressed?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact,
I mean, they're miserable, but they think it's something else is wrong with them.
Yeah, there's a book by a guy named Daniel Amin another doctor named Ruth, R-O-U-T-H, called The Healing Anxiety and Depression. And in the book, they're medical doctors. They describe seven different kinds of anxiety and depression. And there's a self-test in the book that you can take.
Oh, great.
which will make you even more depressed.
I hate those things.
Yeah, I know.
You got a little test about your own spiritual life in here, man. I flipped right by that, man. I didn't want to get any more depressed.
Well, Greg, that's because you're still a graduate student and you haven't really passed yet.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
You'll be able to take these when you've got your degree.
In the summer, I'll do it.
But one of the kinds of depression is one where a person has a low-grade depression for such a long time that they forgot what it's like to feel normal,
mm-hmm,
and they don't know they're depressed, but they're just energyless, and we describe some of that. But you're absolutely right. There are people who can be depressed without actually knowing it anymore because they're so used to it.
Well, I think that's part of it, too, and I think what they're aware of is their misery, but they think they're just unspiritual
or something like that. That's profoundly unhelpful thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not helpful.
And so I'm hoping that what people are doing as they're reflecting or listening to you talk is maybe thinking about their own lives and thinking, gee, you know, I think part of the time we feel badly because we have unrealistic expectations of what life is supposed to give us. I think that's part of it.
And there we've come full circle to this contemporary notion of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a consumer culture, television commercials have as their goal to make you dissatisfied with your life. I mean, let's face it.
That's right.
That way you'll buy their product.
Right. Right.
And if you're presented with this view that life should be like this all the time, you begin to think, gosh, mine's not like that.
Mm-hmm. By the lie is what they're saying.
That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. And then I think people then, partly they get upset because of that, and if they had a more realistic view of life, then they would they would feel better about feeling bad in one sense. But on the other hand, you have sometimes extreme circumstances that over a period of time beat you down. And I think in Christian circles, we're not always psychologically free to look at it that way and to say, you know what, I'm pretty beaten up. And I'm feeling bad because I just went through hell for a couple of years, and maybe I need to face that straight on rather than being in denial.
Absolutely. And rest is often what a person needs when that beaten down thing comes on. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right.
Jay, it has been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for your book, The Lost Virtue of Happiness, Discovering the Disciplines of the Good Life. It will be beside my study table, my study chair, for a long time. And you're such a great friend. Thank you so much for all the influence in my life and in so many others.
Love you and the Enforcer, and I hope that cruise goes well. It's going to be a blast.
Okay, thanks again, Jay.
Love you, Greg.
Dr. J.P. Moreland, and friends, just get this book. Just get it. The Lost Virtue of Happiness. J.P. Moreland, Klaus Isler, NAB Press. We'll have it at Stand to Reason eventually, but get it as soon as you can. Be with you next week for more of the same. In the meantime, you go out and give them heaven, friends. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.